From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, the Thursday night lights of pre-integration black high school football in Texas.
The first time that I heard the term Friday night lights, I had no idea what that meant.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This will be another weekend when America is transfixed by football, not for the action on the field, but on the sidelines. Taking a knee and kneeling during the national anthem in protest against racial injustice in America is a hot-button issue, largely due to the attention given it by President Trump. Trump has called the players who declined to stand during the anthem unpatriotic. He has used profanity to describe them and has called on the National Football League to fire or suspend players who use their constitutionally protected freedom of speech in this manner.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now, out, he's fired. He's fired!
Critics of Trump, of which there are many, say his attacks on the players is race-based and is a deliberate move to excite a mostly white political base. Trump's response is that this is not about race, but about respect for the American flag. However, it's difficult to separate race from the protest for a number of reasons, including the history of bigotry in football. For 60 years, high school football in Texas was under the boot of Jim Crow, was an overt demonstration of the unfairness of segregation in public education. Michael Hurd writes about it in his book, Thursday Night Lights, the story of black high school football in Texas. Hurd is the director of Prairie View A&M University's Texas Institute for the Preservation of History and Culture, which documents the history of African-American Texans.
Thursday Night Lights came about because when I was in high school back in the Stone Age in the 60s, I went to all-black schools, Ebony Worthing High School in Houston, and that was part of the Prairie View Interscholastic League. And the PVIL, I got a brief history here, the PVIL started in 1920 because when the University Interscholastic League started at the University of Texas in 1910, it prohibited black schools from participating from their membership. So the PVIL started up in 1920 and existed until 1970. But throughout its history, and again, I grew up in Houston, and the games for the PVIL schools, of which there were several in Houston, were always played on Wednesday and Thursday nights. So the first time that I heard the term Friday Night Lights, I had no idea what that meant. It was a totally an alien concept to me.
You grew up in Houston, Jepson?
Yes, Jepson Stadium.
And so that was shared?
Yeah, Jepson was the public school football facility.
And so what were some of the teams in Houston, that African-American high school teams that took that field?
As I mentioned, my school, Ebony Worthing. Then there was Jack Yates High School. And Jack Yates, ironically, was right about a block from Jefferson. So they had this incredible home field advantage, the Jack Yates Lions. There were the Cashmere Gardens Rams. They were in North Houston. The Phyllis Wheatley Wildcats, they were in Fifth Ward. And the Booker T. Washington Eagles were in Fourth Ward, and so those are the main schools that played in that stadium. Some of the schools that they hosted came from Austin, San Antonio, you know, the Austin Anderson, and Waco Moore were the Lions, but a lot of the schools that came in came from the Gulf Coast. Schools in towns like Beaumont and Port Arthur, Beaumont Hebert High School, Beaumont Charlton Pollard High School, and Port Arthur Lincoln. But those were the schools that, and of course, those were all PVIL schools, all black enrollments. So those were the schools that were the opponents.
So it sounds like in Houston that there was a very rich culture of black high school football going on at the time. A lot of energy and a lot of interest.
Exactly. One of the things about it, David, was that the first black high schools, the first high schools for black students in Houston, there was Booker T. Washington, started in the mid-20s, and then Yates and Wheatley came along in the late 20s. And so there was this instant rivalry. And so as the communities grew, the majority of black residents in Houston had ties to one of those three schools. And so there were these ready-made rivalries that went on. And through the years, it just grew. It grew out from that. So on Thanksgiving Day, there would be the Turkey Day Classic. And when it was the largest high school athletic event in the country during its run from the late 20s until 1967 when the PBIL went under. But the history of the black community was tied to those three schools and the rivalries and the games that grew from that. So you had all of that wonderful history. And as the communities grew and Worthing came along in the in the early 60s, and of course Cashmere came along a little bit after that. So the communities grew, but those rivalries went all the way back to the early 20s.
And the Turkey Day showdown, the Thanksgiving showdown, was Houston Wheatley versus Yates. And so but there was also the San Antonio Wheatley, also named for Phyllis Wheatley. San Antonio had a different sort of population makeup, so it had an African-American school, but not many of them had one.
Exactly. You know, the majority of the black schools around the state took the names of, people like Phyllis Wheatley, the great poet. Jack Yates was an African American preacher in Houston who started the first black church in Houston. Of course, Booker T. Washington. Most of those schools took those names. So if you look around the state, you know, a lot of the black schools, you know, were Booker T. Washington or, you know, Paul Lawrence Dunbar, and so forth. So again, another tie to black history for those schools.
Now, the reason we have black schools, segregation, which is came about through a court decision, Plessy versus Ferguson, which created separate but equal. But, I mean, were they equal?
No, not in any sense of the word. The black schools were traditionally underfunded, if they were funded at all. And so they lacked many of the basic resources, especially financial, and that set them apart from the white schools. But there was really not much, if anything, that was equal about that situation, whether it was academics or athletics or just your daily social activities. It was truly separate and not equal. And the schools had to pretty much fend for themselves. You know, that's why, again, that's why the PVIL came to be, because the UIL didn't want anything to do with the black high schools and helping them with their competitions. You know, the PVIL provided a leadership for black high school athletics, academics, and music competitions. And that was similar to the UIL, which provided governance for those activities, but for white schools only.
So what I like about your book, and I like a lot about your book, Thursday Night Lights, the story of black high school football in Texas, is that we're not just talking about the gridiron heroics, and that's great, but we're also talking about the history of segregation in Texas. And you write about how not only was Plessy and Ferguson in separate but equal embraced in Texas, but there was also this open hostility in the state towards educating African Americans.
It was a struggle, David, just to get black kids educated, and there was a real fight in the white community. There was the notion that blacks, you know, could not be educated and did not need to be educated, that that you didn't need, that the state or the federal government, whoever, didn't have to spend money to educate black people, because they were mostly illiterate and that they could not learn. And of course, nothing could have been further from the truth. So you have these battles that, you know, back during slavery, there were these black codes that forbade slaves from being taught to read and write. And what one of the things that happened with emancipation in the 1860s was all of a sudden you have 4 million freed slaves, and most of them truly were illiterate. But one of the things that they really wanted was to learn. And for a lot of the older slaves, the one thing that they wanted to learn to read was the Bible, you know, which was something that they relied on for their strength, you know, and their faith. And so after you have emancipation, you have just a ton of black people who are all of a sudden free. But one of the main things that they were concerned about was education. You know, they wanted to learn to read and write. And you have all these black colleges popping up throughout the South, including several black colleges that were founded in Texas, primarily in East Texas, which is where most of the black population in the state was located. So you have these black colleges springing up. And as you start to see black high schools start to be founded, there was this incredible relationship, and it was a natural relationship. You went to a black high school, and for college, you weren't allowed to go to a white college, so you went to a black college. And in turn, a lot of the people who went to black colleges returned home as teachers and coaches, you know, for the black high schools. And so you had that really wonderful relationship. The struggle for education, as we see it develop in Texas and throughout most of the South, those were the kinds of relationships that started. But in terms of this whole separate but equal notion, there was nothing like that. And the struggle for education was pretty mighty. There were a lot of church groups that came along to help get some of these some of the colleges started. The African Methodist Episcopals, among them, were pretty active in that. But you had a lot of church groups from up north who came down and helped get some of those schools started.
Getting these schools started was not easy, and the state didn't help out. And it's in the state constitution of 1866, where they said that, I'm paraphrasing, basically when the legislature got around to it, that they would create some sort of a higher education institution for the colored youth of the state, but we couldn't spend any money on this thing.
Exactly. That was the attitude, you know, that it was a waste of money, a waste of time to try to educate African Americans, and there was just this incredible reluctance to do that. And you know, it took the Merrill, the land grant, the Merrill Act that created land grant colleges for something like Prairie View and some of these other schools to actually get started. You know, Prairie View is second oldest only to Texas A&M. And it's located, ironically, Prairie View is located on what used to be actually a plantation. But there was an extreme hesitance by the state to fund education for African Americans.
How did Texas become so football crazy? And when did football first come to our high schools?
College football started at Princeton, Princeton and Rutgers in 1866. And it finally got to Texas, you know, towards the turn of the century. And then early in the century, around 1909, you started to see high school football teams appear. And exactly where the mania took hold, I'm not sure about what that, you know, what that time frame would have been. But as the sport grew nationally, as it grew at colleges, Texas, Texas A&M, and so forth around the state, you know, it just kind of picked up steam at the high schools as well. And of course, that filtered into black high schools. And, you know, it was just this whole, I guess, macho thing about, you know, football being a rite of passage and young boys growing into young men by playing the sport. And it just kind of took off, and it just kind of snowballed. And as it did for the white schools, so it did for black schools.
This is Texas Matters. I'm David Martin Davies, speaking with Michael Hurd, author of Thursday Night Lights, the story of black high school football in Texas.
What do you think it meant for the players, African-American young men, who are going to get a chance to go out and play on the field in front of their friends and family and community and demonstrate their abilities?
The thought that blacks were incapable of doing anything. And now here you have this group of teachers who found this league for to govern African-American high school competitions. You know, for these kids to be able to get out on the football field and show what they can do athletically, you know, to show off their physical skills, but also to show off their mental abilities. They could evolve into being coaches. They could be leaders of men. It could all start by being able to perform on the football field. But for a lot of these kids also, football was a way to get out of the cotton fields, to get an education, and to make something of your life, and to prove society wrong. I can do this. I can succeed. I can be a productive citizen. And it all started with being able to show what you could do on the football field. So you performed on the football field, and you got an opportunity to go to college and advance your education and advance your opportunities or your chances for opportunities to succeed in whatever came after college.
And I would be amiss to not mention that Barbara Jordan, she didn't play football, but she she was academically excellent, and she mm-hmm. competed in the PVIL.
Oh, exactly. You know, and Barbara Jordan was an example of the incredible number of PVIL students, you know, who were not athletes. You know, someone like Mickey Leland, who was also a Phyllis Wheatley graduate. I mean, you had people like that, you know, because, again, you know, there were the academic competitions and the music competitions, and the kids who came out of those competitions were incredible. And a lot of them went on to make their name nationally and internationally.
Eventually, we have Thurgood Marshall and Brown versus the Board of Education, and we're going to get rid of separate but equal. We need integration, and that brings a new day to Texas. But this was complicated, and you write about it very well in your book.
Integration didn't sit well with most white citizens in Texas and the school boards around the state. I point out in the book that when the Brown decision came to be, that forced the UIL to face head on, really for the first time, integration. What are we going to do? Because they had restricted black schools and from participating in the UIL, and schools that had black players could not participate in the UIL, not that there was that many, if any, actually, before Brown v. Board of Education. But when that came out, El Paso was the first to say, okay, we're going to integrate our schools. All right. But what's that going to mean for our UIL membership if we have black athletes participating on our teams? And that forced the UIL to step back and respond to that, and for the first time give some thought to, well, what are we going to do with integration? They all knew it was coming. It was just a matter of time that was going to happen. But El Paso forced their hand and made them start to think about that. It was written in their charter when they started in 1910 that their membership was open only to any public white school. So when integration comes about, they have to change their constitution, and they can, and that's what the El Paso school board forced them to do. El Paso, San Antonio, Corpus Christi, and a few other towns that didn't have large black populations were among the first, you know, to adopt, you know, the Brown v. Board ruling. When it came about, then the UIL stepped back and said, okay, how are we going to deal with this? You know, we're not going to just say, okay, you guys are out and you can't compete. But they actually went in and they changed their charter, and it was basically just an editing decision. You know, they just removed that section that said their membership was open only to any public white school, and proceeded from that point.
And that took effect in 1967.
Yes. The merger with the UIL, and I call it a takeover because basically it put the PVIL out of business. 1967 was the first year that the fall of 1967 was the first semester that black schools and white schools began to compete against each other, and white schools began to field teams with black players. A few had done it before then, and again, San Antonio is a good case in point. Though Wheatley didn't join the UIL right away. Wheatley stayed in the PVIL to the very end, and so did Corpus Christi Coles High School. I think they stayed in it until the very end as well. And I call that integrated segregation, you know, because they were still all black schools, you know, but they were not a part of the UIL, though they had the opportunity to do that.
So this really gives us an opportunity to talk about the complexity of integration. And you write about in your book how that there's a loss of culture through integration, and especially for the coaches. Now, the students, there were a lot of white schools that were happy to take these very talented students, black students, and put them on their team. You write that there were probably some white coaches that wanted to speed up integration so they could get these players. But there was the black coaches who really worked very hard and were very passionate, and this was their lives. And suddenly they lost a lot.
They did. Basically, they lost their jobs. They lost their careers. You know, a lot of those coaches who had won state championships, who had won district championships, or who just had good programs and were good coaches, you know, a lot of those guys left the profession altogether. Some of them were bumped up into administrative positions, you know, assistant principal and that sort of thing. But integration didn't really help black coaches at all. I mean, it really hurt black coaches because good coach or bad coach, the jobs that were available to them, and this especially hurt the successful coaches, the jobs that were available to them would be to join the staff at a white school, because most of the black schools just went away. And all the kids had to go to white schools. But the jobs that were available to them was as an assistant coach, you know. And a lot of those guys didn't want to do that. They didn't want to take that demotion, which is exactly what it was. So, you know, they left the profession, or they were just really unhappy with the positions that they had been put in. Because they had, I mean, there were some just incredible coaches who came through the PVIL. Pat Patterson comes to mind at Houston Yates, who to me was the best of the bunch. Pat was just an incredible coach, and his program at Jack Yates High School in Houston was one of the best overall, you know, in the country. I mean, Pat won state championships and produced some incredible players. And when integration came about, Pat ended up working for the Houston Independent School District, working in an administrative position. But integration overall hurt black coaches around the state. They lost jobs. It just really put them in awkward positions. Because a lot of it, too, was basically, you know, when those schools closed and the black kids had to go to the predominantly white schools. White parents did not want black teachers teaching their kids, and they didn't want black coaches coaching their kids, especially when it came to discipline. Integration meant that black coaches really had to take a step back.
That's not to say that integration overall is negative. I imagine you're saying it's just that we lost a generation, and there were sacrifices that were made, and we need to recognize that.
Exactly. And just looking deeper into black culture in general, a lot of people in the black community look back at integration, and I say so here in the book. You know, some of the coaches talked about not wanting integration because they knew what was going to happen, and what was going to happen and what did happen was there was this loss of culture. You know, there was this loss of history. You know, it wasn't being talked about. It wasn't being taught, you know, in the communities. The communities fractured. Black communities began to break up because there were more opportunities, and families could move around. They could move to quote-unquote better neighborhoods. They could move to quote-unquote better schools and that sort of thing. But the culture itself really suffered, you know, with integration, and a lot of black families look back on that time as being the time that the culture really again took a huge step back.
You are preserving the history of the black high school football experience. I mean, a lot of this wasn't saved.
Exactly, and that was the most difficult part about putting this book together. The schools themselves did not do a good job of preserving that history. They didn't do a good job of preserving the statistics. Most of what I found came through doing searches for through black newspapers that have survived and been kept online. But even at that, a lot of the stories that I found were just brief and incomplete. The white dailies didn't cover those schools, just to mention here and there, you know, and if there was a playoff game or a state championship, they might do a little bit more. But on a regular basis, there was no consistent coverage, you know, so there's a lack of official records. I mean, there's no way to say, you know, Joe Smith gained the most yards in PVIL history. You know, he was the leading rusher in all of PVIL history. There's nothing that says that, you know. And even some of the records that do exist are some of them are questionable. You know, you can't say that this coach or that coach won this many games and so forth and so on. So the records are spotty at best. But I feel good about how I went about it and the records that I could find and put together and mention. One of the things that I did in the back of the book was a listing of the PVIL state football champions.
Michael Hurd is the director of Prairie View A&M University's Texas Institute for the Preservation of History and Culture, which documents the history of African American Texans. His latest book is Thursday Night Lights, the story of black high school football in Texas. It's published by the University of Texas Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. And you can write on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.